You are listening to. First Gen Teachers Lens. Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of First Gen Teacher Lens, another version of our book talk series. This episode we have Dr. Bradley Conrad. In this episode we also talk about his book, Lesson Planning with a Purpose, and what it means to truly and intentionally plan with purpose. Stay tuned. Peace.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. You can find out more at teachbetter.com/podcasts. Now let's get back to the episode.
All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the First Gen Teacher Lens podcast. Today, we have another terrific guest in our book talk series, Bradley Conrad, who's an associate professor at Capital University. He's an author, and he's also a team lead of a blog called Tales from the Classroom. Here is to introduce himself.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today. Love your show, and I'm glad I can be a part of it.
Thank you. Thank you. I know we connected through your blog, Tales from the Classroom. Before we get into your book, which you've written, Lesson Planning with Purpose, right? I want to talk about or touch upon, how did you start or get into Tales from the Classroom?
Oh, that's a great question. So it kind of goes back to my days in K-12 education. So I was a high school teacher for a little bit, about 10 years or so. And almost all of my career spent in highly impacted Title I schools. And in that time, what I came to find, as much as I absolutely loved being with the kids, is I started to begin to feel, I want to say voiceless, powerless. Mm-hmm. I felt like we were particularly targeted because, you know, we would get measured by standardized tests and things of that nature that we all know as educators aren't necessarily revealing of what's really going on in a school. They're more linked to socioeconomic status. And obviously mm-hmm. that's tied to race and ethnicity because mm-hmm. of historical reasons that I won't go down that rabbit hole. So in short, as I've gone long, I wanted to make a difference. I got very tired of the negative narrative around teachers and teaching. Mm-hmm. And I remember really vividly, I was about 2011, 2010, there was a Fox News story that came out about how teachers are lazy and entitled. Mm-hmm. And that was the most unbelievable, sensationalist thing I'd ever heard, because mm-hmm. that has not ever been even remotely my experience. So as time went on, and I had these experiences in K-12, and I'm feeling as though like we're not being heard, and there's these people that, you know, that are making educational decisions that don't know anything about education without asking anybody who does know anything about education. I really wanted to provide a platform to sort of, I call it the counter narrative to what's mm-hmm. going on in education, to say, I want the public to know what's really going on in schools. Mm-hmm. By 2017, I launched this. I collaborated with a lot of really smart and incredibly talented people to help sort of formulate the idea. And now that now we have a network of K-12 scholars, teachers, et cetera, across the country, frankly, across the globe, mm-hmm. that are involved with this in a number of different capacities. So our hope is to give a platform for teachers, for students, frankly, for educators of all sorts, mm-hmm. To tell their stories and to sort of really reveal what's going on in schools, and to what my friend called it, a form of public pedagogy. Mm-hmm. We want to teach the public like what's really going on,
right?
And do it in a very balanced kind of way, right? It's not a narrative of everything's great in education, because that's just not true, right? I mean, we all know that. But we are trying to sort of present a counter narrative to the dominant one that isn't very unflattering.
Right.
So that was Tales.
Yeah. No, it makes sense, especially with your last point in terms of teachers. You know, I've been thinking about the pandemic a lot within my podcast, and like, you know, talked about episodes about the pandemic, but there was that one point where last year where teachers were lauded in a sense when mm-hmm. it first hit and there was everything shut down. Kids are at home, parents are like, there's so many mechanisms to being a teacher and we don't even think about it. Obviously, you know, once you get, and you never really get it down, you more so like know kind of like, you know, a little bit like of your teach moves, your teacher personality as you get mm-hmm. prolong your career. But to say that we're like privileged and like, or lazy in the fact that's not true. I, like, you know, when you think of like salary pay, and I'm not gonna go down this, as you said, rabbit hole too much, but mm-hmm. there's a large pay wage gap for over 20 years of, in terms of like teachers getting adequate pay. And I know teachers
right
in my school building who've switched careers and have 3 or 4 degrees because they were in this one career and it said it wasn't fulfilling. Cause like, you know, teaching yeah. in one aspect, you don't get paid monetarily, but you get paid through, you know, working with the youth and hoping that they attain something valuable, whether it be like, hey, down the 10 years later, I see a kid that I had in 7th, 8th grade, right? Hey, are you still teaching this story? I know I've done my job. Like where yeah. they, because there's always that saying, you know, students wouldn't remember mm-hmm. like what you taught them, but they remember how you made them feel, whether it be something funny in class, being interpersonal. But, you know, I'm great that you're, I was on Tails because it does provide very meaningful content, especially for anybody that is looking to be a teacher or who is a teacher now, just feeling the burnout, if you will, of like, you know, the career, because it is real.
It is. And I appreciate you saying that. You know, what's interesting what you were saying is there's been a bunch of research. I did an interview recently here in Ohio about the teacher turnover and what's COVID going to do to teacher turnover, right? So I dug really deep into this research on why are teachers leaving. What's interesting about what you're saying, sort of underscoring your point, like pay is low on the list of why teachers leave. Mm-hmm. It's one of the bigger reasons is a lack of autonomy, mm-hmm. Being treated like they're not professionals. And at the same time, the low social standing of teachers in this country.
Right.
You know, it's sort of, I remember before I got into higher, it's so interesting and almost mind boggling. Before I got into higher ed, when I would go to like a social gathering of non-educators, right? People would be like, oh, what do you do for a living? You know, typical middle-class question ask, mm-hmm. right? And I'd be like, oh, I'm a teacher. And I'd get reactions like, oh, that's so cute. Or that's so wonderful. Like almost like patting me on the head is, you know, like almost demeaning. Like, I know they're maybe not meaning it that way, but it came across that way.
Yeah.
And then, and now, you know, when people say, oh, what do you do? I'm a professor. Like, oh, well, tell me more about that. Right. It's a very different reaction.
Right.
And it doesn't make me feel, I'm not saying that that doesn't make me feel good, frankly. Right. It makes me want to work harder and in the work that I'm doing with you and others, to really elevate the teaching profession to where it deserves to be. Like it isn't a lot of other places, frankly.
Right. No, definitely. I've gotten those kind of awes before where it's just mm-hmm. like, you know, kind of adorable kind of sentiment, if you will, where yeah. it feels like, hey, you are doing like a job that like nobody wants. But then I think of that poem by Taylor Malley, who like, what does a teacher make? And like, mm-hmm. that's a very critical poem in terms of like the viewpoint and aspect of teachers yeah. in our society. Because, you know, if you think about the history of education, teachers at one point were this upper echelon kind of field where it was instilling, you know, kind of philosophical, I mean, we still do like philosophical kind of questions about our society, incorporating, sure. you know, that in-depth, humanities that was, you know, still embedded, but like nowadays, like people think like we're overpaid babysitters. Like that's what it feels like. But yep. In terms of your book and in terms of like lesson planning, sure. I looked at the title for like a really long time, and I was just like, you know, planning with purpose, right? Those two mm-hmm. things kind of stuck out to me. So where did that kind of come about? How did you and your, I guess, team of other authors create that kind of title?
Yeah, that's, we thought a lot about that. That's a great question. And speaking to my other authors, Christy McConnell and Bruce Ermacher, who are two very good close friends and colleagues. We've written a lot together. We work together, and Christy actually is so good at titles. She's like the branding queen. I said she would have been so great in branding. So we were thinking deeply about what to call the book. And we use the phrase a lot of times throughout our careers, teach with intention, right? So we often say the best teachers teach with intention, right? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? So that means that, you know, we have thought behind most, not everything. I mean, that's just not reasonable. But through the majority of things that we do in a classroom, we're intentional, right? If we're going to ask the kinds of questions we ask, the kinds of experiences we're going to provide for kids, the kinds of lessons that we're going to write, and so on. I could go down the line. So before we wrote the book, we had written some articles on different approaches to lesson planning. Specifically, the one that really kind of put us on the map was the aesthetic approach, the CRISPA lesson plan model. Mm-hmm. So we've done, you know, countless workshops and PDs and so on and so forth. And we would write papers on it, you know, like, and hit the conference circuit to talk about this work. And interestingly, our friends in teacher ed started to say, like, y'all should write a book, because when I teach about lesson planning, like, I kind of like give them Hunter a little bit, and then that's it, you know, and then they're on their own. So we started to do like deep dives into like research on lesson planning and, you know, what's out there. And what's interesting is like, when you look at the scholarly research, I'm not talking just like the how to, you know, lesson planning for dummies world, right? Really not much of anything had been done on lesson planning in the scholarly literature since the very early 1980s. So we were like, that seems insane, right? Because what happens every day in a classroom, right? A lesson plan. Yeah. Like, that is the crux of what happens in a school every day.
Right.
So that kind of all came together to be like, all right, we need to like write a book that's very, we wanted to write it so it was accessible to teachers. Mm-hmm. And like, we were all teachers, you know? And we really hold close to that. Like, we're not those typical ivory tower, like, well, you know, we're just going to stay up here and write out to our scholarly journals and not talk to anybody else. And I'm not saying that's not a knock on scholarly journals. That work is very important.
Right.
But we wanted to speak to a practitioner who wanted to have the research to back up what it was that we're saying that they might want to do. Right. So we tried to bring both, right? So we did the hard work of like, here's the, every, you know, we've got the five lesson plan models, right? They're all based thickly on theory, right? Tons of research went into that. But we try to write it in a way of like teachers that anybody, any teacher could like pick up and relate to, whether they're elementary school, high school, middle, whatever, doesn't matter what subject matter. And we really tried to do that. So full circle, we wanted to arm teachers to be intentional, right? We wanted them to just say, I'm not doing this because I went to a professional development on best practices of lesson planning. So that's why I'm doing it, right? When your administrator goes, why are you doing what you're doing? Which you get asked quite frequently.
A ton of times, yeah.
Right? This way you could say, well, here's exactly why I'm doing it. And if you want the research to back up what I'm doing, here it is. So this isn't just like, you know, we thought these would be cool, neat, fun ways to lesson plan. These are research-based practices that are very applicable and doable in any classroom. So that's sort of where the title came from.
Gotcha. No, it's to me, like, intentionality. Like, that's one thing that I want to say my dean brings up all the time. Like, what is the intention of, you know, this hook or this activity? What are you trying to get from these students? Like, when we talk about, you know, checking for understanding, right? You're asking questions with intention to what you're teaching, right? So that really stood out to me in terms of, like, got me thinking, like, all right, so when I'm planning, you know, I do the classic, which I saw, you know, the I do, we do, you do, right? Mm-hmm. And they chip them off, right? But then you think of like other like formats of like lesson planning, like, where you are, you are you in a sense like planning with intentionality? Like, are you grasping every reader or every learner, whether it be a BL learner or a student, you know, whose second language is English or another language, right? Or special needs students, right? Because a ton of times, like, you find that like teachers do this just generic lesson plan and it hits certain points, but it doesn't really have that intentionality behind it where it's like, all right, I've addressed all the needs of my learners, so they all benefit from this entire lesson. So that's very important.
You know, and here's the thing, like, so I'm a curriculum person, right? That's my background. Mm-hmm. I am a firm believer that those who control the curriculum are those that have the power within the classroom, right? So when you see things like scripted curricula, I mean, it's how much more disempowering can that be for a teacher? How much more deprofessionalizing can you be than to give a teacher a script to read off of, right? So that's another sort of, I don't know, act of, as Freire might say, an act of subversion. That's inherent in this book is we're trying to empower teachers.
Right.
We are teacher advocates to empower you with and see the value of the curriculum. And I mean, I just see so often in my own career, and then now that I'm still in schools all the time, right? Mm-hmm. That notion of like, oh, I'm just going to print up a lesson plan and well, I'll just do that, right? Which I understand. I did that too. I mean, everybody's done that, right?
Yeah.
But to be armed with the tools to be a really intentional curriculum maker empowers teachers.
Right.
And that's what we really wanted to do here. So I hope that we accomplish that end, because that is, I mean, this book's a labor of love, not just a labor of love, it's a calling, man. I mean really, it's a calling.
When I was like you know, I didn't fully read it, but like, you know, once I was picking it apart, I was like, a lot of in-depth research went into this. And then you and I talked about on Tales about we didn't mention it, but before I talked about my own experience while I was student teaching about scripting, and it's not only like it, like, and not to make everything about, you know, race or ethnicity, but like in a sense, like, you know, you talk about losing your voice, like mm-hmm. a lot of like the interpersonal and, you know, kind of code switching from like, you know, teacher to, you know, for me, I grew up in the city. So like, you know, that those colloquialisms that like you grew up as a kid and like, you know, you hear like in New York, there's this always like year. That's like a thing. And then like you make connections to those kind of words. And then like, you know, to have it scripted, it's not like you're this automaton, you're a human, where at times I'm not going to follow a script. Like, this isn't right. Netflix of teaching. Right. So like, it's not, the fluidity loses itself because it becomes this task where you have to memorize this prompt that was not made by you. It was made by somebody else who probably 100% doesn't know what's going on in your classroom.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's part of your culture, right? I mean, it is. And to take that away. And then, and, you know, and on the other end, like we just wrote an article, we haven't had published yet, or, but we're hopefully we will, is this notion that like do a scripted curriculum it inherently ignores the culture of the individual students in your classroom, mm-hmm. right? No one from outside your school can write curriculum like you can.
Right.
Because you know your kids, you know your room, you know who they are. And if you're, you know, if you're a quote unquote perceptive teacher, which I know we're going to talk about, mm-hmm. you know those individuals in your room. So you can write a curriculum that is inclusive, equitable, and responsive to those individuals in your room. It's impossible. I mean, I couldn't do it. You know, I'm a curriculum specialist. I couldn't write a curriculum for your classroom. I don't know your kids.
Right.
And to presuppose that I could is just foolishness.
Right. Right. No, I definitely agree. And I guess this leads me to my second question. You talk about neutral act. So what exactly is a neutral act in teaching, and how can we prevent that or circumvent?
So I love this. So this, that actually comes from Paulo Freire, who, if those of you who are listeners have not read, you need to read Pedagogy of the Oppressed from 1970. It is a seminal work. And in that, in his work, Freire actually is quoted as saying, teaching is never a neutral act.
Mm-hmm.
And what he means by that is that teaching is, no matter how you slice it, it is inherently philosophical, it's social, it's political. And we make decisions based off of all of our influences, our beliefs, and our experiences, right? And those have consequences for our students. So we sort of use that as an underpinning for which we're gonna talk about next, perceptive teaching, is that teachers really need to understand who we are, mm-hmm. What our beliefs are, and how that influences our decisions on the everyday. Mm-hmm. And actually, Banks talked about multicultural literacy. Mm-hmm. And he said that it, quote, consists of skills and abilities to identify the creators of knowledge and their interests, mm-hmm. to view knowledge from diverse ethnic and cultural perspectives, and to use that knowledge to guide action that will create a humane and just world. So right. The idea there is not that teachers have to be the end all be all when it comes to culture, but we kind of are, we need to be students of our students' culture. And mm-hmm. our own culture. We need to be aware of who we are as cultural beings and who our students are as cultural beings. And that's upon us to be able to create these spaces that are, you know, that are meaningful for kids, that are relevant, that are, you know, inclusive. Mm-hmm. Because it's so easy for kiddos to check out when they don't see themselves reflected in the curriculum, right? That's the tenet of culture responsive teaching.
Right.
So that's the idea of teachers becoming really aware that it's not a neutral act. It's not just math is math, mm-hmm. right? Or I'm teaching Shakespeare, Macbeth. It's teaching Shakespeare, Macbeth, no matter what context I am, and no matter who I am. Right. That's not true. So that's kind of the idea behind teaching is not being a neutral act.
Right. So I guess the way I internalized it was to be in quote unquote, we hear this term all the time, is to be lifelong learners, right? To be forever evolving, right? Like certain things like you learn from your kids. Like I learned even if it's outside the curriculum or even in the curriculum, like there was this trend. I think it was like maybe last year or 2 years ago that like I didn't know about, and then I saw my students doing it, and then an article came out about it, whether or not is it harmful or is it helping our society. And like there was like talks about, you know, fidget spinners, right? Whether or not those are either hindering students who have kind of like behavioral issues where they need to kind of touch something tangible, and then there's actually like tangible research towards that where it helps some kids, and however like certain schools looked at it like in a negative aspect where it was like distracting. But you know, those incorporating those things that are in the know-how about your students' lives are important. And I guess that's the way I internalize it, where you're being proactive and connecting the content and making it relatable, not only relatable, but digestible, I think is a good word to kind of say that, like, all right, I'm teaching the standards in a way that is, you know, pushing my students like academically, but also it's making it relatable to the point where it doesn't feel like they're learning in a sense, they're learning internally where it's through enjoyment.
Yes. And that's a big thing what we really push, like with the aesthetic approach to lesson planning, with the ecological approach to lesson planning, and even with the integrated social emotional approach, is focusing on, well, frankly, even the constructivist approach, focusing on meaningful experiences, mm-hmm. right? We've got to give them meaningful, engaging experiences around the content where they see themselves in it, that it's something relatable or something that's valuable or relevant. Because if not, I don't know about you, man, but... even now as a learner, if I don't see relevance in it, I'm not interested. I don't know if I don't want to learn it. And I'm a 45-year-old man, right? So we're talking about, you know, kids. I don't know that there's anything, I don't know, I won't say it that way, but it's one of the more important things as a teacher to help the kids see relevance in what they're doing and to give them meaningful experiences.
Right. Or else like, your lessons become archaic, right? In a sense where it becomes very
boring.
Yeah. And it being, and then if you, my number one thing is like, if you have them hooked, your students, or like, you know, you'll get good reviews in terms of like, like the students are hooked in terms of the lesson, and then engagement is half the battle of like that can really make or break a kid that has severe emotional, maybe behavioral issues for other teachers. Yeah. That has happened before where like today I was teaching Lamb to the Slaughter, which the kids love this story. And I had students that weren't as participatory before, but today they were like nonstop talking. So it does prove like worthwhile where you engage them in terms of like, you know, figure out what kind of stories they're like or what kind of genres they're into. But to our third question, and you mentioned before, how can teachers develop qualities of perceptiveness? I noticed in your book that you have, I believe it's 8 tenets
of
perceptiveness, where each tenet kind of talks about a different aspect of lesson planning in some type of form.
Yeah, so let me give you the background on this. So we call it the perceptive teaching framework. And it has been developed over, it's been 12 years, about 12, 13 years it took to develop this framework. It is built off of, we've done extensive literature reviews, right? So literally just about everything that's ever been written about culturally responsive teaching, just about everything that's ever been written about in educational psychology and motivation literature on what really good, effective teachers do. Mm-hmm. And then off the general education literature on what effective, quote unquote, quality or effective teachers do. I hate to use that language, but successful. I mean, you could pick an adjective. And then our own research, right? So we synthesized this enormous body of literature and did a ton of field work ourselves. And we tried to look at like, what is the, I used to say it this way, what's the it of teaching? The it, right? So like you can look at a teacher and there's a lot of people can be like, I can tell that they are good at teaching. But to be able to put your finger on why. So we turned to the literature and then did our own research and came up with this framework, right? So we break one up into two parts. There's who I am and what I do. Mm-hmm. So who I am includes, and there's a lot to unpack here, and I won't do that with you today because I don't want to bore everybody and put them to sleep, but I'm open-minded. Really good, excellent teachers are open-minded people. Mm-hmm. They don't always accept everything that they're handed. They're very discerning, but they're open to new ideas, open to different kinds of people.
Right.
Self-awareness. They're aware of themselves, They're aware of themselves, aware of others, how they relate to kids, etc. Open to feedback. Caring. They believe that, you know, they give care. They try to have a culture of care, etc. Really important. Mm-hmm. And they're authentic. They're genuine. They don't show up as some totally different person where if they saw you on the street, they'd be like, wow, you're so different in class, right? But there are filters, of course. Like the way I am at the bar when I'm watching the Browns game is definitely not the same as I am when I'm with my students. However, I'm not all that different. It's just my language is a little bit cleaner. And then there's what I do is the second part. So that includes personalizing the educational experience, which we've talked a lot about, being culturally inclusive, culturally responsive, differentiating, etc. Teaching the whole person, like not just about content, but about helping them become, you know, focusing on the social, the emotional, helping them become better human beings, etc. Teaching with intention, which we definitely talked a lot about, and then finally developing autonomy is helping them. I like to say one of my mentors in teacher ed, Rich Biffle, always said, we're working ourselves out of a job. And I always liked the way that he put that we want kids not to need us anymore. And that's really what developing autonomy is about, is to sort of help them find those tools of empowerment that are already within them so that they don't need us. So what we found is those things, those are the qualities that really great teachers do. Now, here's going to your question, and this is important. Some people call those dispositions, right? And that's a weighted term. So we kind of stayed away from that. Mm-hmm. But these qualities are malleable, right? Mm-hmm. We're not fixed, right? Even right now, you might not be an overly authentic person, but if you want to, you have to make that choice. You can develop that. So there's all kinds of different ways that we can do that through reflection, through, watching ourselves teach and having someone sort of talk through this. We've even developed different protocols for teachers to be able to not be evaluated, but to sort of see where they fall on the sort of paradigm of these different these eight different qualities. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways to develop these things, but there is no magic checklist for how to be a good teacher, right?
Right.
As close as I can give you. This is, right. And it's not the magic. There is no magic bullet. I'm not right. making that claim, and I never mm-hmm. would. This is as close as I can give you as from everything that we know in educational research about what good teachers do. This is as close as I can get.
Right. No, it makes sense because I think a lot of, and for me, like my background is like, you know, hence the name of the podcast, First Gen Teacher Lens, where first one to kind of supersede this realm of academia of like, you know, undergrad, graduate school, right? And then like mm-hmm. looking at the percentage of my background, right? How many graduated graduate school, got their master's degree. So like we navigate this like kind of liminal space where you're learning the field and like there's this always this like kind of hyper weighted sense of where like am I actually doing this right, and especially in student teaching where you feel like I don't know what the heck I'm doing, right? Like that was my whole sentiment during student teaching, where I was just like I have no idea what is going on right now and am I being the best teacher I can be. And honestly, no, the answer is no, because like every year you progress and you become better and you learn a lot of new things. And one thing I learned is like teachers don't reinvent the wheel. Like I was reinventing the wheel during student teaching, where I was just like everything has to come from me, and like I was not looking at resources that were already out there. It's only a couple of years ago where I can, like you said, make my own, which can personalize the lesson. And move on to the next question and our last question. You mentioned the word celebrate in your lesson plans, which seems non-traditional of lesson planning. Where does idea come about, and what is the importance of celebration?
So that's really born out of the constructive lesson plan approach to lesson planning. So it's called the EL Dr. C model, right? And it comes from DePorter and her colleagues at Quantum Learning. And the idea is at the end of the lesson, and it definitely permeates into the other lesson plans, like certainly it's in the ISO lesson plan and CRISPA and others. It's this idea that you've got to save space at the end of any lesson to sort of celebrate what's been done. And you can, and celebrate isn't just let's high five each other, or you know what I mean? It could be. But it's this idea. I always saw it as a space where students can capture their learning in the integrated social emotional approach to lesson planning. And in that literature, that this notion of reflection and brain breaks are really important to sort mm-hmm. of reflect on and celebrate and make meaningful connections, totally culture responsive pedagogy, right? Make connections to self in meaningful connections, and to sort of celebrate what you learn. But as a teacher, I think of it as a place to uplift students. So I would think of celebrate. I would use celebrate. I still do to this day. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I teach students. I teach classes on like how to lesson plan. Right. I teach them this lesson plan model, and I totally do what I teach them is I use it as a place to sort of build a community and sort of lift. Not their spirits per se, but to build their self-esteem and their self-confidence in what they've done. So things like, I love, X, Y, and Z of what you did today. Your creativity was phenomenal. And here's mm-hmm. a concrete example of what that looks like. I can't wait for tomorrow. That does a lot of things.
Right.
That does, right. It lifts their self-esteem. It gets them to buy into you. Mm-hmm. It gets them excited. It makes them feel successful. And I think that's really important to do within the lesson plan and then in the lesson plan, but on a grander scope, successes. And we talk about this quite a bit in the book is a lot of times when we hear lesson planning as teachers, it's almost like you want to like gasp, right? It's like mm-hmm. this thing that you've got to do is a technocratic act. We've often called it, you got to do for somebody else. You got to write lesson plans and turn them into your principal, right? It's just like, oh, I got to do this. We are trying, and in this book, we really try to show the readers how teaching can be a creative rewarding and like celebratory act, if you will.
Right.
So we hope that, you know, by offering these five different approaches to lesson planning and sort of talking about unit planning in a grander context, a little bit teasing the next book, that teachers can shift their perspective of lesson planning from something that's like they gasp at to something that they actually look forward to.
Right.
And in all the workshops that we've done over the years, we found that like, that's kind of what happens. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. We've done workshops where like teachers have literally like cried and said, I forgot how fun this can be and how meaningful education can be, because I get so stuck in standards and requirements that they forget how meaningful and creative this all could be. So that's kind of what that alludes to.
No, it definitely makes sense changing that notion of lesson planning, right? There's like this stigma, especially within like schools that like teach to the test, where right, where it feels like that you are tied, or if not married, to the standards, right? And you have to hit those standards or else you're not doing that your job, and that consumes your lesson plan, and you can't be as creative as you want it to be, right? So definitely I like the aspect of celebration within lesson plans, whether it be like, you know, shout outs, closing rows. Those are two things that like you can do in your lessons and like incorporate, whether it be like, you know, intangible feedback.
Right.
But I want to thank you again for being a guest on the First Gen Teacher Lens podcast.
Hey everyone, so I want to thank Brad for being a great guest. You can catch him on his website, www.lessonplanningwithapurpose.com, or you can catch him on www.talesfromtheclassroom.com. He also has a Twitter, Plan With A Purpose, Tales From The Classroom. It's a NCLA, or you can search him up on Instagram. Stay tuned for more. See you next time. Peace.
Thank you for having listened to the First Gen Teacher's Lens. We'll see you here next time.